Welcome to the Dow of Sports Podcast with Troy Kirby, covering sports business with over 300 industry leaders from across the globe. Now, here is your host, Troy Kirby.
Thank you for listening to the Dow of Sports Podcast. I'm Troy Kirby, along with episode 505 of the podcast. Now, today's guest is a sports security expert. His name is James DeMayo, and he really focuses on how to prevent a lot of the problems that people see. You're not going to prevent everything, but really communication, how to deal with a lot of people that may be yellow jackets, those game day people, but they're not there during the week, and really how to make sure that the fan experience, which we all talk about selling, is at an all-time high continuously because we make sure that we brace for the possibilities. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to correct everything, but it does mean we have to have the conversation. You know, it's important that I'm, you know, talking about James DeMayo. I actually, you know, last night saw Jurassic World, and, you know, I kept thinking the entire time, you know, maybe it's not dinosaurs that we deal with, but it still is entertainment, and it is the idea that, you know, you're trying to protect people, and yet you have such dangerous things around. And of course, that in the case of dinosaurs, I still don't understand how any insurer in the world insures that Jurassic Park. But the same thing goes for sports. I mean, if you look at sports, the amount of things that can happen in a sporting event may not be, you know, as big as a dinosaur, but they can be just as deadly. So it's important to really talk about those things and really go over what is sports marketing. In a way, it is sports security. So a great conversation with James DeMayo right here on episode 505 of The Dow of Sports.
Want to spread the word about the Dow of Sports podcast? Please like an episode and share it on your Facebook or Twitter. You can even rate and review the podcast in iTunes, which helps us gain new fans by moving up in the iTunes rankings. Some sports executives are also sending the link to the podcast to their coworkers for a listen. Every little bit helps, and the Dow of Sports podcast thanks you for your efforts.
James, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. My question to you is, are our stadiums secure? And if not, how do we make them secure?
Sports security is certainly a fascinating, interesting niche market. The challenges continue on a daily basis. To answer your question, it's difficult to kind of just, pinpoint it because there are so many different challenges that we're seeing throughout stadiums and venues, not only here throughout the United States, but certainly throughout the world. So threats and vulnerabilities continue. Certainly doing stadium assessments is important. But I'd like to be of the mindset that training is an ongoing process, and certainly the folks that work within the stadiums and venues should engage in the active learning process of continuing their training to be the most proactive security leaders they could be.
One of the issues with stadium security is that people see it sometimes as a ruse to keep them from bringing in peanuts or bringing in water bottles. Is that really, you know, what we have to worry about when it comes to mass stadium appeal and whether or not we have, you know, an issue within the stadium? Or is that honestly something that, you know, maybe gets a lot of play in the media but is not necessarily what we're looking at?
Well, certainly the media can sensationalize it to a certain degree, but between, you know, educating the fan base, the codes of conduct, certainly, you know, you can get that feeling as a patron entering a venue that, oh, I'm going to be hassled again, you know, in terms of water bottles and whatnot, similar to, you know, maybe what you may get, obviously, at, you know, an airport kind of scenario. But these procedures and protocols, especially in professional sports, are put in place to protect the patrons, protect the players, protect the brand of the organization, so for that the 2.5 to 3 hours that you're inside a stadium, arena, or venue, the folks that are entrusted with your responsibility have that duty of care to make sure that they're doing everything within their powers to make your environment safe and enjoyable. So certainly the media can play up on it, but, you know, there's just too many folks in the industry, Troy, that are committed to making a difference to not only public safety, but to make that game day fan experience enjoyable for everyone that comes out to the ballpark.
Well, the bottom line is still the bottom line. How do you make sure that people that in a lot of ways are game day operators, I mean, with the yellow jackets, the folks that are doing some of the majority of security, at least from the crowd and ushering point of view, a lot of times they're not there, you know, Monday through Friday. They're just there for games. How do you make sure that they're trained up and they're capable of taking on this type of task?
And that's kind of you know, my common cause in terms of reaching out to the venue directors and the security managers, because there are challenges with part-time staff. I mean, again, great question, because, you know, if you're working, let's say, an event, you know, in January, let's say a baseball game or something, a football game, and now all of a sudden you come back a month later because you're a part-time employee and you're working a circus, let's say it's an indoor venue or something completely, a completely different demographic. The folks that, that wear those yellow jackets, as you described, they're entrusted with that responsibility to not only know what to do in times of crisis, but certainly know where the exit doors are and how to lead people to safety if there's any type of adverse situation, security breach. So, yes, definitely challenges, and I've been really proactive in trying to reach out to the folks, just, you know, sharing knowledge between law enforcement, venue directors, staff, to make sure that everybody is not only on the same page, but certainly speaks the same language in the case of any type of true emergency. So again, it is a challenge. I'm a strong proponent of cross-training between guest services and security, but also making sure that, you know, the idea of having these mini huddles 5 minutes before game time is just not going to work. You have to engage the employee in active learning, and certainly reach out to folks like myself and folks in the industry who are really committed with the training component, train the trainer, but the continuing education side of it, to make sure that these folks that are there part-time know exactly what to do in times of crisis.
Is there the perception, or at least the idea, that has helped sports venues that they're so well protected that there's absolutely no way that a terrorist or somebody who wants to come in can harm people? I mean, has that actually been fed into the public? Because we haven't seen major terrorist attacks, even though we have a mass amount of people in one area.
You know, certainly terrorism is a major concern here throughout the United States. But, you know, it's regardless of the vertical, Troy, that you're working in, it could be retail loss prevention, it could be obviously event management, stadiums, it could be corporate America. You have, you know, active shooter scenarios, you have workplace violence, you could have a disgruntled employee who was terminated 5 minutes before game time, and that is a situation that stadium security and law enforcement may have to deal with. You may have civil unrest going on outside a particular symphony, let's say in Oakland, in reaction to what happened with Ferguson and Baltimore and different police-related shootings throughout the United States. So it's not only just terrorism, but it's many, many different challenges. Certainly here in Central Texas, we're dealing with drones and open-end stadiums, whether it's Circuit of the Americas or the University of Texas with the Longhorns. Obviously, there was a performer just recently in Mexico who went to grab one of the drones because they were using it as part of you know, the filming for the show, and he cut his hand. So drones are definitely a challenge. Weather conditions, certainly, at open-ended stadiums. You know, tornadoes and inclement weather, whether it's Florida or obviously Central Texas. These are challenges that continue on a daily basis, and really the need for training cannot be underscored.
So you mentioned the drones, and we just had the Philadelphia Phillies have a drone that went over the third baseline. Somebody decided to fly it into the stadium. My question is, how much of an effect on public safety is that? And how much of a concern is that, not from the standpoint that somebody might see something, you know, in terms of a baseball game through a drone or whatever the live feed is and that kind of nonsense of rights, but how much of a danger is it to the actual public safety of those 30,000 that are actually in the building that this is going on?
Well, I think it's a concern. I think it's something that the Department of Homeland Security is actively monitoring, and there's always that, Troy, that double-edged sword between the free market enterprise groups that want to obviously use them for recreational purposes, and as you mentioned earlier, the other group that may want to utilize that technology to attach some type of, you know, chemical or biological agent to the drone to cause mass destruction. So it is a concern. Certainly, you know, Circuit of the Americas, if someone is recreationally using a drone a quarter mile from the stadium because they just want to take aerial shots of Grand Prix racing or whatnot, if for whatever reason, if they're not highly skilled on how to operate that particular drone, it could cause a catastrophe. And you certainly wouldn't want a drone to go into a crowd of people. It's no different than a wheel flying off a race car at 200 miles an hour. You know, there's definitely more disadvantages to advantages. So I think it's an ongoing conversation between DHS and certainly professional sports. That, yes, it's great technology, and I had the benefit in March of going to AT&T Stadium and seeing actually a drone launched inside that building, and to see how that technology was utilized responsibly. So yes, great question. Continuous challenge. Obviously, you know, the rules of the game seem to change in terms of, you know, what's allowed and what's not allowed within close proximity to a stadium. But I think the key, Troy, is that the folks that are operating the stadiums, if they encounter a drone scenario, to know exactly, you know, how to mitigate that risk to the greatest possibility, but also have a protocol and a procedure in place in terms of reaching out to law enforcement to assist them with handling that type of scenario.
But you know that, you know, with stadium security, a lot of people will give it lip service, including the owners, including the top franchise executives. But at the end of the day, it still becomes in a lot of ways like IT. Even though we have to protect our IT and we want to protect our data and we want to make sure nobody accesses it, it still becomes unsexy or it becomes a budget line item. How do you make sure that becomes a concern beyond just a little bit of lip service?
And I had the good fortune of going to Indianapolis last July for the NCS4 conference, and they had the CEO for the Cleveland Cavaliers talk about the business of sports. And we talk about, obviously, you know, ticket sales and game day experience, but also trying to look at security, certainly not in a reactionary fashion, but more in a proactive kind of mindset that it creates added value. And certainly, you know, the challenges continue to remain, but whether it's, you know, you look at the Dodgers, what happened in their scenario with the Brian Snow incident in 2011, they were cited for inadequate security and they were sued for $15 million. So that was a very tragic situation for all parties involved. And even here in Central Texas, with the organizers of South by Southwest, last year there was a drunk driver fatality case where we're obviously now we're finding out, as tragic as that situation was, there's also litigation involved. So getting back to your original question, I think the key is to get the folks that own these particular venues to understand that security needs to have more of a prominent role and a seat closer at the head of the table in terms of operational discussions, because really at the end of the day, if there's any type of adverse situation, certainly your brand could be tarnished or adversely affected. But you want to make sure that folks have that great game day experience, they feel safe, and you want them to make return visits. And I think that's the challenge, is to not be excessively overbearing in terms of screening measures, but to create that good relationship with the fan, see something, say something, just to let them know that we're here to help them, protect them, not be overbearing, as mentioned, but create that wonderful experience so they'll come back. And I think that's the challenge that the marketers have, because you know, certainly folks do have so many other options, whether it's satellite TV, internet, it could be, you know, AAA baseball, something that's more cost-effective for the family budget. So that's where the marketers are really trying to create that synergy with the fans. And certainly we have the NBA Finals going on tonight, but, you know, case in point, I think the Golden State Warriors do a great job of connecting with their fan base, utilizing their iBeacon technology. So I think apps and technology and security and operations and guest services all play a pivotal role in creating that relationship with the fan.
So how do you make sure that you not only have a seat at the table, but you have a voice? Because you can have a seat at the table and they can render you off to the side. Is that really having that sports security, you know, personnel really go over the game plan from Monday through Friday before the games even come? You mentioned the 5-minute huddles, and I've been a part of those. I don't know that people really register a lot from them. I mean, is that really, you know, more of an active role that really it comes down to the same way a marketing plan initiates? You really have to be involved.
You have to be involved, and I think obviously in light of recent challenges, you know, the marketers are starting to understand obviously that you know, security is something that, you know, we all have to deal with, and they are aware of everything that we talk about, that we research about, and you know, to a certain extent, it's status quo, but you don't want to be that one organization, Troy, you know, that's cited for not doing everything you can to keep people safe. You don't want to be, you know, the test case scenario where, well, they didn't do it the right way in L.A., so let's do it, you know, the right way somewhere else. You don't want to be that, you know, kind of person, and you know, in that scenario. And if you look at, you know, the Boston Marathon, as tragic as that scenario was, 26.2 miles is a very soft target, very difficult to secure. But we've learned a few years later now that they use the terminology in the industry known as lessons learned, the ability to kind of go back to the drawing board and figure out, you know, what we did wrong and let's improve upon it to make people safe. So, you know, I am a strong proponent of sharing this knowledge. You know, I think there's too many people, like I mentioned earlier, that are committed to the cause. Just recently, there was a woman that ran a 5K, I think, in Chicago, and she ended up showing up at the finish line, you know, collecting her $1,500 prize. But the irony of the story was that she ended up at the finish line. She got past all these security checkpoints, and she cheated. So that was her worst mistake, thankfully. But the reality is if somebody after Boston can do that, then we need to do a better job of making sure that we're credentialing, that we're checking people, that we're asking questions, that we're just not letting people slip in and out of the cracks.
I'm wondering if political conventions have helped build essentially a security plan for sports in general, because they are done in the same type of, you know, environment. They are done in sports facilities a lot of times. You'll see the major conventions will always have protests outside, or they'll have somebody that, you know, really we have to, you know, guard these assets because it might be a president of the United States, a potential president, or, you know, a governor, et cetera. Has that actually helped develop, you know, really some of the logistical, you know, scenes in terms of what we need to do in order to secure and lock down a place, but also make sure it looks friendly enough that people still want to visit? Because if you make it look like Fort Knox or a prison, nobody's going to want to come into it.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I think the International Association of Venue Managers, Russ Simons, they just did a webinar 2 weeks ago, and they talked about, you know, a situation, as I mentioned earlier, in Oakland, where the woman, ironically enough, her dad was a retired detective, but, you know, she was running a symphony with 4,000 people in the building, and a quarter mile away, there was civil unrest. So she had the presence of mind of kind of sheltering in place, you know, while those, protesters were literally, you know, outside her building, kind of dimming the lights and just kind of sheltering, you know, that scenario. And thankfully, the crowd passed by without further incident. But I think that was, you know, a credit to, you know, what she did to kind of mitigate any potential risk from happening. I mean, Alan Johnson with the Orlando Magic, you know, discussed a similar scenario. You can imagine trying to get 14,000 patrons into a Magic game while there's literally civil unrest right outside your building. So whether it's, you know, political causes, whether it's sports and entertainment, I think the key scenario, Troy, is that the folks that are entrusted with operating those facilities and keeping people safe, and again, it could be FBI, DHS, venue directors, the guys and gals in the yellow jackets, as you described, everybody's speaking the same language and making sure that, you know, there's a unified command, there's a unified communication system in the event of an adverse situation.
Do we, though, sometimes just take it on face value if it says FBI that that means that they're the best? I mean, there's the old joke that the worst student in a PhD graduating class is still called doctor. Do we still have that issue with, say, you know, FBI or security personnel who are, say, our, you know, consultants, that they're taking every measure possible when they may not be the best at what they're doing?
Well, I don't see that as an overriding concern. I see it as a situation is that, you know, whether it's consulting, whether it's, you know, on the Fed level, whether it's the frontline security staff, folks that do this kind of work, Troy, they do it twofold. One, they have a passion for keeping people safe, and also they have a passion for sports, and that's how they feel their skill set fits in to this environment. And I think they really want to make a difference. Because, you know, every time they put that uniform on and they go to the stadium, arena, venue, they don't want to be the ones with the responsibility of knowing something went wrong, God forbid, that they didn't do everything they could possibly do based on their training and knowledge to make sure something bad didn't happen. So I don't think that's an overriding concern. I think, again, the NCS4 is a terrific organization. They have a conference in Orlando. I attended last July. There was over 400 industry professionals. You know, from the highest levels of government to the sport management majors and in between. So I think there's really people that are committed. They're cognizant of, you know, the challenges that are out there. I'm not really again, that's not an overriding concern. I just think that folks really want to do this because they just, you know, want to make a difference in so many ways.
So how does this affect really sports marketing? You know, giveaways are a big component, especially in minor league baseball. But even I in the early 90s was, you know, part of a game in which everybody started throwing balls onto the field. You've got now projectiles that people were handed, you know, by the marketing staff. Does that, you know, come into the fold when you're doing a sports security outline of what you can and cannot give away and how to make sure that you both have fun, but at the same time protect, you know, not only the fans, but also the players, which a lot of people don't consider as much that the players have to be protected, you know, more than the fans. But a lot of times they're almost a victim being on the field in the spotlight, you know, at the mercy of what the fans want to do.
Yeah, again, another terrific question. And I go back to, you know, lessons learned. And I think it's incumbent upon the security leaders to go on YouTube, to go on social media, to find out, you know, what, I hate to say this, but what other people are doing wrong, you know, whether it's a marketing, you know, situation where they're projectiling, you know, T-shirts into the stadium. You know, you don't want anybody to lose an eye, literally. So find out what people are doing wrong and improve upon that in terms of safety. You know, if it's a hockey game and you know, do you allow, you know, laser pointers in, you know, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. Discuss it with your marketing team. And again, that's the key, Troy, is to have these discussional meetings, you know, prior to, you know, whatever the event is, and making sure that, you know, again, fans are safe, having a good time, but no one gets hurt, because that's where the risk mitigation and the liability scenarios come in if there's, again, some type of an accident. So, again, you know, I think the training is key, but most importantly, too, is that communication of understanding what marketing's role is, understanding what security's role is, understanding the operational side of the business, to obviously, you know, put the fans in the seats, but also keep them safe while they're watching a particular performance.
You mentioned litigation, and I think that's an important concept. I remember back in the early 2000s, they had a hot dog launcher where they were, you know, shooting hot dogs into the crowd, and people were actually avoiding the hot dogs because they were flaming hot. And, you know, basically becoming, I guess, hot pieces of meat thrown at people. My question is that not the way that we can not only maybe, I'm not saying restrict promotions, but also make sure that they're safer? Because with sports security and sports litigation, nobody wants to basically be sitting in there in a, you know, deposition 6 months later explaining why they shot hot dogs at people.
Right, exactly. And I think that's how risk management attorneys make their money. You know, as unfortunate as it is to say, it's really just when bad situations happen. And I think, you know, the sign of any good attorney is to share information to try to mitigate that risk through training and knowledge. So you know, the hot dog scenario certainly can cause problems, and the marketing folks want to have their impact on the blueprint of the organization. But at the end of the day, there are so many inherent liabilities within the confined space that you're working in. Obviously, you know, whether it's a hardened target like a physical structure or an open-ended stadium, there's always that risk of, you know, slip, trips, and falls. And it's nice that, you know, you pay $5 for a beer or whatever the cost is, but, you know, if your alcohol beverage control team is not monitoring, you know, the possibility of over-serving someone, or if your housekeeping staff is not looking at the concourse floor to make sure that there's not any, you know, spilled beer or popcorn or candy. Those are potential risk liability situations, and they need to be cleaned. Those spills need to be cleaned up immediately. And I think that's where the proactive, mindset comes in, because obviously if something it creates a precarious situation for a well-paying patron, it's incumbent upon the folks inside the venue to do everything they can to take care of those scenarios.
What you've just laid out is not really what people would normally consider sports security, but guest services. But don't those two really mesh together in a lot of ways in making sure that both guest services and sports security have not only a plan, but have a focus on making sure if we have to get everybody out, if we have to secure people, or if we have to protect people from things such as spills or cracks, we know how to do it.
Exactly, and that's why I mentioned earlier, it's just how I'm a strong proponent of having those pre-event meetings between guest services and securities, because the fact of the matter is during any type of, you know, security breach, everyone is going to be, you know, wearing multiple hats, Troy. So it's not, you just can't sit there and say, well, it's not my job, it's securities. It's really everybody's job, you know, committed to the cause, making sure that we're doing everything we can to be as proactive as possible to reduce any potential risk. And I think that's, it's twofold. It places the ownership groups in a great position, and it certainly places the fans, who are paying the salaries of the employees and helping with the profit margins for the ownership group. It places everybody, on the same page in the interest of public safety, which is a very good thing.
One of the things you always hear is, well, we don't have the budget for that. But my question is, isn't that really you just don't want to spend on it? Because you'll see them spend on other things. Is this really one of the last frontiers of things that you almost have to make an argument for, even though it should be a no-brainer?
It should be a no-brainer, and it is a constant uphill, battle, trying to sell the added value of security. But you're absolutely right. I mean, and as I mentioned earlier, you don't want to be that test case scenario of where everything went wrong because you're trying to save a few pennies. So I think if you take the time, Troy, to educate your staff before potential problems happen, I think that puts you in a position of strength. And certainly, I mean, I'm not an insurance agent, but I would imagine if you owned a venue and you called your insurance carrier and you said, hey, listen, I'm going to bring in this security consultant or this operation expert or whatnot to help us, mitigate risk. Could we get some type of reduction on our policy? I'd be hard-pressed to think that they wouldn't want to work with the venues if they're being proactive in trying to educate their staff to their fullest abilities.
Do you still get pushback from franchises when you do mention security, or is there more acceptance and is there more of a welcoming in and the idea of, look, we'd love to learn about these things, nobody really talks about it?
I think it's the latter. I think it's more that there's, they're understanding now that, it is important. And again, for many, many years, Troy, the asset protection discipline has been kind of viewed as reactionary in nature. But as I mentioned earlier, in terms of the recent challenges, and it could be, the Boston Marathon bombing, it could be the Newtown shootings, it could be, the Mall of America, which is a very soft target. It could be, police shootings throughout the United States. I think, the scenarios continue to come at the folks that are entrusted with that duty of care, as I mentioned. And I think it's becoming more a prominent theme. And as I mentioned earlier, to everyone out there that's listening, sports security is a very interesting field. And for me personally, I've been in the industry nearly 25 years in terms of law enforcement, security, and consulting. And I think, at the end of the day, with all the challenges that come, what makes it so exciting for me is that, I really keep going back to the drawing board. To ask questions, to research, to learn. I'm blessed to be considered an expert by two magazines, and that's an honor in and of itself. But the reality, Troy, is the folks that work inside the venues, they are the experts for me. They're the ones, whether it's the 49ers, Levi's Stadium, or the Golden State Warriors, or, the Round Rock Express, they're the ones that come back to me and share information and tell me what their challenges are so I can work with the researchers. I can, do my due diligence to share my knowledge to make sure that everyone is speaking the same language and certainly learning everything they can, which is cutting edge, to make a difference in the interest of public safety.
Well, you opened up the Barclay Center. You were part of that security team there. What were some of the things that were put in place to make sure that a billion-dollar facility is protected in a place that really there had not been that type of environment in Brooklyn before, at least, for the last 50 years? I mean, how do you make sure that you really protect against something when you have no prior record of incidents or anything else to really go on and make sure that you're doing it right?
Well, again, thank you for that question. And it was an honor, obviously, working with AEG as security supervisor, grand opening the Barclays Center, which was a tremendous experience, with Jay-Z, Beyonce, Barbara Streisand, college basketball. Just seeing, that building basically from the ground up. And as you mentioned, it's been 40 or 50 years since professional sports had been in Brooklyn, obviously, with the Dodgers moving out to L.A. But I think AEG and Four City Radnor and the folks that were entrusted with setting up that scenario looked around, different venues throughout the country and shared information about, best practices. And I think that's the key. I had a conversation with a gentleman from the Washington Nationals last week who's a student of the game, and he talked to me about sharing best practices and information. And I think that's really where the key comes in, is sharing knowledge with each other. We had this fence jumper, let's say, at a Houston Dynamos game, and we had this other scenario at a San Diego Padres game. But just getting on the phone and sharing that information, training together, working with law enforcement. The Barclays Center, again, as you can imagine, trying to evacuate 18,000 patrons at a Brooklyn Nets game in a densely populated area in regard to the Long Island Railroad and the MTA. Extreme security challenge. So whether it's the NYPD, AEG, Forest City Radar, everybody working together, Troy, to make sure that, you know, God forbid, again, if there's some type of, you know, adverse situation, that everybody is, you know, working together to make sure we can do everything within our powers to keep people safe. So again, that was a great scenario for me, and the great folks at AEG taught me a lot, and certainly an experience that I'll always remember.
One of the things that comes out of that, and you mentioned Beyonce, you mentioned some of these stars that you'll see, and then there'll always be the occasional, you know, security person that will try to get a, you know, selfie or a photo with, you know, these stars, and then they'll get reprimanded or fired. And I know there's always this social media outrage towards how dare we do that as a organization. But my question is, isn't that because we're more worried about them being complacent at the other security checkpoints because they're so worried about something like a selfie that they're not worried about making sure that somebody else doesn't come through that facility and cause harm?
Absolutely. Your point is well taken. And I think if I remember the scenario, there was a security guard with the Patriots. I think who took a picture, a selfie with Tom Brady, and he was terminated. And one of the things that you're taught right from the beginning is what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do. And there's obviously no fraternizing that's allowed with the professional athletes. You're there to make sure that they're safe. And I think there's just the perception, as you mentioned, you know, once it does hit social media, well, people are going to look at that and say, well, what is that guy really doing or that gal really doing? Are they too busy just being starstruck, or are they really trying to make a difference, you know, keeping people safe? So I think there's a certain protocol, and there's a certain, you know, standard of excellence that is required of people, you know, entrusted with that responsibility within the security parameters of the operation. So, you know, social media is huge, and I think that, you know, it's a big part of any business plan is to make that connectivity with the social media platforms. But fans want to live in the moment. They want to, you know, go to that experience and you know, just enjoy the process. So I think it's incumbent for security to have kind of a, not so much have tunnel vision, but have open-minded, you know, a lens to see exactly what's going on and not so much get caught up in the celebrity of the environment.
You're a former police detective, retired. My question to you is, how do you deal with people who, every time that you interact with them in your capacity, you're typically reacting with them when they're having their worst day of their lives? No matter what it is, they're not having a good time when they're really meeting a police officer because there's a crime that's been committed or something that they're complaining about or some issue. How do you make sure that you deal with that in the proper manner when everybody else is having an absolute worst day? And conversely, when you're seeing people at a sports stadium and they're having the best time possible and the, you know, most exciting time, and then here you have to be, you know, that person that has to basically inform them that, you know, this has to happen or this correction has to happen or we have to move these people. I mean, how do you kind of blend those two together? Because they're such polar opposites, but they really kind of mesh into you being the bad guy in either scenario.
Again, another terrific question, and one of the things that I learned in 21 years of law enforcement is that your actions, Troy, have to be reasonable and necessary, and you have to be able to articulate everything you do. And I think the ability to communicate with people on a human level, to de-escalate situations, to you know, engage in verbal judo to a certain extent. And you can imagine, you know, your points are well taken, but you know, you can imagine trying to deal with an intoxicated patron who's been drinking for 3 or 4 hours. And now they're creating some type of disturbance. And you know, as security, you've been alerted to respond to that area to mitigate that risk. You have to have a thick skin. You know, people are going to curse at you and they're going to try to disparage you. But you have to be, you know, someone who has a command presence kind of scenario. But you're looking to kind of calm the situation down and not escalate anything worse than it could possibly be. And I think that's where all the cameras come out. That's where people start watching every single move that you do. But that's the role that you take, you know, when you accept this responsibility of being in this environment. And I think it's key to just, you know, calm down the situation, you know, try to remove the person from that scenario as gently as possible. without, you know, obviously making it worse than it can be. And I think the keys for security is to be an effective communicator and to create that relationship with the fan. And sometimes, you know, it doesn't work that way. People can be totally unreasonable, but you have to do everything in your power to make sure it doesn't get worse than it can get, obviously.
Well, James, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. What are some of the things, if people wanted to really kind of investigate what you're doing further and kind of getting a hold of you, how would you tell them to best, you know, kind of go about those avenues? If they say, I really want to learn more about sports security and I want to know how to get better, or I want to know how I can, you know, really get, you know, James on my team.
Well, Troy, again, thank you for the opportunity and everyone listening in on the podcast. This is just a tremendous resource for me to work with Troy and you know, all the great things he's done and obviously interviewed folks throughout the industry. But I would say that, you know, one of the best things to do is to join, obviously, some groups on LinkedIn. And I've created a couple. One is called Sports Security Professionals. The other is Central Texas Sports and Entertainment Network. I would align myself with the NCS4. Which is affiliated with the University of Southern Mississippi, Dr. Liu and his good folks, and certainly here in the Dallas area with the International Association of Venue Managers are great places to start in terms of getting resources. I know NCS4 has the CSSP, which is basically the certification process for folks that work inside the venue. So those are definitely good places to start, Troy. I would certainly just start Googling everything you possibly can on the Internet about sports security. If this is something that you find interesting. But, you know, my feelings are that if you really want to get into this industry, and it is a difficult industry to break into, you can find your niche. And I always tell the students when I do my presentations that you may not necessarily be interested in security in the beginning, but, you know, take the position, learn that aspect of the job, and then maybe kind of transfer over into marketing or operations or guest services or conversion crew, whatever does interest you. But the key is, Troy, to get physically into the building. And that's through internships and obviously working with professors and social media connections and just, you know, availing yourself of being open, obviously, and humble to the gifts that are offered by folks that are inside the circle. And I think that's the key is, you know, once you do get inside the circle, people will embrace you and just be willing to learn and do the work that's necessary to make an impact in the industry. Thank you.
Well, fantastic stuff, James. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. Have a good day.
Thank you for listening to the Dow of Sports podcast, focusing on the world of sports business. Download our free iPhone, iPad app in the iTunes App Store and Android app available in Amazon to listen to the entire archive. Or check out sportsdow.com for more podcasts, blog posts, and videos. All episodes of the Dow of Sports podcast are copyrighted and trademarked.